Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Welcome back, everybody, to a bonus edition of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. A special edition for you because it has been a wild week in the NBA. Coaching changes galore. I bring in the Vertical's front office insider, Bobby Marks, to talk about those changes and who could be next in some of those situations. That's next, the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Welcome back. Bonus edition of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Glad you could join us. And we're doing this bonus podcast this week because it is a Black Thursday in the NBA where you had coaching changes galore, Washington, Sacramento, Minnesota, among others, possible coaching changes opening up in the next couple of weeks. And I wanted to bring on Bobby Marks, the front office insider over at the Vertical, longtime NBA executive, and he's kind enough to join me here on the podcast. Bobby, did any of these coaching changes surprise you?
No, not necessarily. I think more of when the timing was. We didn't even get to midnight on Wednesday night, and we already had, you know, three openings with Washington, Minnesota, Sacramento. The Washington, a little bit, and I actually thought Randy Whitman did a good job this year, but I get it. It's year five. You've gone to the Eastern Conference semifinals 2 years in a row. But for where that team was, battled injuries, he kind of kept them afloat, kind of fell apart at the end. So no, not necessarily. None of them surprised me. More about the timing right now.
So you thought Randy Whitman did a good job? Because, I mean, that's the one that didn't surprise me at all. Because, look, it's hard to gauge everything that Randy did from afar, but you know, that team underachieved. They underachieved big time. And I thought they underachieved in parts during the regular season the last couple of years. They were a very good postseason team, which I guess is all that really matters at the end of the day, how far you go in the postseason. But I just never thought that Randy Whitman was getting enough out of that team.
Well, he did a good job when their backs were against the wall, and I mean that when they had eight guys on the roster and they were in, and they had all those injuries. I thought he kept them afloat during that period. It's funny, when they started playing poorly is when they almost had a complement of a full roster. And so, yeah, I understand that's more of an indictment of the coach. I did like how he kind of kept them in the mix. That was a batter team. You know, the Allen Anderson injury really hurt them this year, and we all looked at that team on paper in the off season, and we, you know, their depth was, I thought their depth was really strong. And their bench kind of, you know, let them down a little bit. The Beal injury, not knowing, you know, how many minutes he can play, you know, going forward, you know, was a sign that, you know, that team was going to struggle to even, you know, sniff the playoffs and everything.
You know where I think they made a mistake too was they kind of did a 180 at the start of the season about how they were going to play. I mean, most of the years that Randy was there, they were this kind of, you know, miniature grit and grind type of team. They played two bigs. They were one of the few teams that did that. Then in preseason and just before the season, all of a sudden they're going to play small, they're going to play faster. And I remember going down to D.C., early in the season and talking to John Wall about this transition. And one of the things John said right away was, we're not really in shape quite yet to play that style. I mean, I don't know. Should they have done something different earlier? Should they have made the switch at all, the kind of transition they did to a smaller lineup?
Well, their personnel, you know, stayed pretty much the same. I know they lost Pierce and they basically replaced him with Dudley, but everybody else was back. So they kind of changed your philosophy on how you want to play in the beginning of the year, then go back midseason and then go back again, is you're really kind of grasping at straws right there. And it's hard for players to adjust to situations like that, especially when you're accustomed in the style. And to be a running team, if you're not in, you know, if you want to be a running team, you better come into camp in good shape. You know, you can't all of a sudden get in good shape during the season. It's very hard to do, and that's where we've kind of seen a lot of injuries come about.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. Like, if they decide today, and I'm talking about the core of the team, Wall, Beal, Otto Porter, if they decide they want to be or they need to be a running team next year, they got to start almost in a week or a month or whatever it is and start getting in that type of shape. Because I think on the perimeter, they've got the guys that can play that style of basketball. They're athletic there. John Wall, nobody's faster than him. Bradley Beal, when he's healthy, he's built to play that way. It seems like they've got the horses on the outside that if they, you know, dedicated themselves to conditioning in the offseason, they could come back next year and play that style.
No, you're right, and we'll see whatever direction they go in with the coach. You know, that's going to change as far as, you know, what the philosophy is, what type of style that coach is going to want to play, where some of these the personnel or the players fit into his personality. But they do have, you know, with Wall and Beal and Porter and, you know, Kelly Oubre, what they drafted.
Yeah.
They do have some nice young pieces that are, you know, still on some manageable contracts. You'll have to figure out that Beal contract this summer when we all know kind of where that's going to go. And, you know, Washington really doesn't have much of a choice here.
How big, you know, put your front office hat on now. How big a conundrum is Bradley Beal at this point? Because like a year ago, Bobby, I thought it was a lock that he'd be a max guy in the offseason. Whatever that number was, I thought Bradley Beal would be that guy. Now, the leg injuries popped up again this year. He had that, you know, ill-timed quote talking about maybe I have to be on a minutes restriction for my whole career. How big a risk is Bradley Beal right now for the Wizards?
Well, and I thought he was probably the best two guard when we started, you know, the month of November. And
yeah.
He had a great stretch early on, and then it's not, you know, he didn't sprain his ankle or he didn't hurt his shoulder. This has kind of been something that's lingered, you know, throughout his, you know, his rookie contract with his, you know, leg injuries and everything, you know, the stress reaction that we've seen. So it's something to be concerned about, especially where his salary is going to be. You know, you're looking at a contract north of $20 million a year. You've got to, you know, you got to be somewhat creative. We saw the Lopez contract, what Brooklyn did. You know, can you kind of go in that direction and give yourself some protection? The downside is that all it takes is one team out there to come in with one of those big offers, and then you're kind of, then the Wizards' hands are tied. So they've got the control, you know, with restricted free agency until that team comes in with that offer sheet.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd be afraid of matching a four-year offer sheet. I might be nervous giving up a five-year max offer sheet. 4 years, even if it's a disaster, you're at least a little bit more protected on that back end. But 5 years, max dollars. I mean, if he's healthy, he's worth it. If he's healthy, I think he still can be, you know, one of the best two guards in basketball. But it would scare me with all the injuries he's had over the years, just how likely it is he's going to fulfill that potential.
Well, he's still at a good age, and we don't
sure.
know if with this new collective bargaining agreement, will there be another clause in there, you know, for the amnesty provision that we saw back in 2011. So will there be something in there where it can protect teams a little bit here on the back end with some of these new contracts? We're not sure. You know, you've got the stretch provision, but God forsake, if you don't want, you're not going to stretch out, you know, $7 million over I don't care how many years, and I don't care that this cap is going to go, you know, through the roof and stuff like that. To have on your books, you know, a $20 million player or a $25 million player with an injury is still a bad contract.
And just to be clear too, his team, you know, full disclosure, his team has said to me earlier in the year that they felt they had the leg stuff under control. Mark Bartelstein, his agent, said he feels they've figured it out. So, you know, they feel they've got it under control, and if they do, I think he's worth the kind of risk that they're talking about with the money. If he doesn't, that would worry me a little bit. All right, push this forward a little bit. You know, we're hearing Scott Brooks' name associated with that job. I happen to like Scott Brooks a lot for that job. I mean, I think one of Scott's most underrated attributes is player development. I think he did a terrific job with Russell Westbrook, a terrific job with Reggie Jackson. You know, people look at the talent Oklahoma City has, but I don't think they respect enough just how hard it is to develop talent and to get talent beyond just the raw fledgling stage. Scott Brooks did whatever you want to say about his play calling, and that was an oft-heard criticism in Oklahoma. But he developed that team really well. And if you've got two young guards in Wall and Beal, I think he'd be a great fit down there.
Well, and especially in Oklahoma City, it's not like you just threw the ball out and let him go play.
No.
And what he did last year with Durant being injured was, you know, he got him to the finish line and, you know, a game short of getting into the playoffs and kind of mixing and matching. So you did see a coach kind of grow that year. You got away from that two-headed monster with Westbrook and Durant, and you leaned more on Russell and some of their younger players. So there is a huge feather in his cap as far as from a player development standpoint. You know, a lot of those kids there, or now they're grown up. You know, he kind of led them down the right path here. And you know, when you draft a player, that's one thing. But what happens, the next, two or three years is another. And, that's a big credit if there is success on your player development staff as well as your coach.
And I think it's important, too, that as we talk about Scott Brooks for that job, I know there'll be people in Washington listening being like, well, Scott Brooks, let's connect a dot. He was Kevin Durant's prior coach. It gives him a better chance of signing him. I don't think that's true. I think Scott Brooks or no Scott Brooks, Washington is not high on Kevin Durant's go-to list. I think people think the connection of D.C. is more of a positive than it actually is. You've got more experience with understanding guys going back to their old neighborhood. I know, remember when you were in Jersey, Brooklyn, there was talk of Lance Stephenson going back there, which I thought would have been a disaster if that happened. But it's not always a great idea to send a guy home, I don't think. And I don't think Kevin Durant is in any rush to get back to the old stomping grounds.
No, and we had Stephon Marbury back in the late 90s, and it was a train wreck. I mean, it was an absolute train wreck, and we brought him in, and we made a trade with Minnesota, and Calipari wound up getting fired like 3 weeks later, and I remember seeing the family room having like 200 deep in there with 80 Marbury credentials, figuring out what's going on here and all that, and it doesn't work out that way. As far as you want it to, a fairy tale ending with some of these guys bringing them home, but there's a lot of internal pressure. You've got the ticket request, you've got more friends, a lot of more friends hanging around. You can't really rely, focus just on your craft. There's a lot, you got the charity end of it, the community appearances, everyone kind of is grabbing at you. So I'm not big on bringing players home, back to their roots and everything. I think it's a good story, but I don't think it helps the organization out.
Yeah, you bring in Scott Brooks, you're bringing him in to coach young players, Wall, Beal, Otto Porter. You're not bringing him in as the final recruiting chip to get Kevin Durant. All right, let's move on to Sacramento, a team you wrote about on Thursday. I wrote about on Thursday. George Karl is out as the head coach of the Kings. That is the least surprising news of the day. He should have been fired back in February. It wasn't working back then. I don't know why they extended the charade any longer than they had to. Now he's gone. Now the Kings are looking for a new coach. But the names that are being floated out there, Tibbs, Brooks, Kevin McHale, I just don't see credible head coaches going to a situation like Sacramento, where the owner is unstable at the moment, and the GM, who I think is a smart guy. I actually respect Vlade Divac's intelligence, but to be a GM and run a team, you have to have either a truckload of experience yourself or have staffers underneath you that have a truckload of experience, and he doesn't right now. I don't know why anyone would think a longtime head coach with options would really consider that situation.
Well, and it's been such a rotating door. I think this will be the seventh head coach for DeMarcus Cousins, and I didn't have an issue with the firing of Karl. I had an issue with him being hired.
Yeah.
And last February when they went through that, and my issue with that is that if you're bringing in new management with Vlade Divac and Pete DeLisandro is kind of on his way out, and I'm sure that that was the mindset of ownership when this hiring happened was, why would you hire a coach before your new GM is coming into place? And that it never works out. I saw it in Brooklyn. Avery Johnson was hired first. Billy came in next. Billy King came in next. It just never pans out that way. So my big issue was with the hiring last year. I thought they should have just waited, wrote it out with Ty Corbin, or had somebody else kind of fill in, and then kind of go with a clean slate last summer. So it's been a rotating door. You've got to rely on your strengths, which hopefully will be management here, to bring in somebody, and you can't go big swinging here. You got to be realistic as far as what you can get out there. It is not an appealing job right now. There's not much of an infrastructure with young players coming up the pipeline. We did see some good things with Willie Cauley-Stein, and Macklemore has not panned out that way. So it's not like Utah or Denver or Portland, some of these places where you've got a nice young base of players, plus your picks are going all over the place, you know, the next couple of years. So I think you just have to be realistic as far as what names are out there.
I think you have to decide to exactly what it is you want to be. And Vivek Ranadive, the owner, has been pretty clear that he wants to play fast. That's why George Karl was brought in. He is one of the ultimate up-tempo coaches. But if you want to play fast, what are you doing with DeMarcus Cousins? DeMarcus Cousins is built to play in the half court. He's built to play low post. If you believe that DeMarcus Cousins is the guy you want to build around, which I think as they get closer and closer to his free agency is a little nuttier by the day, but if you believe DeMarcus is the guy, you've got to bring in a coach whose strengths fit what DeMarcus does. That, you know, Kevin McHale, from a tactical standpoint, makes sense. He is one of the greatest big men to ever play the game. He has been a tutor to guys like KG, to Al Jefferson, and others in his past. You know, Dwight Howard, obviously, in Houston. You're not going to get him, but that at least makes sense to me. You've got to start thinking about how your roster fits your coach and the style you want to play fits your coach.
Well, I think what Sacramento is going to have to do is figure out what the Cousins piece first and everything as far as where he goes, the face of the franchise, and with the coach, you know, you better, if you're going to play a certain style, you better have the horses to do so. And you've watched Sacramento games. I mean, there are certain times when Cousins doesn't even make it back half court.
He doesn't.
And he's back. I mean, he would fit perfectly in that 4-on-5. I guess that wants to go on down there. And so if you're going to want to play up tempo, he does not fit one bit. And maybe in small stretches, but Cousins is interesting. I love his talent. He is, offensively he is skilled, but there is something about him where when he, you know, it's almost like, you know, popping a balloon and the air kind of comes out of the building or on the floor and everything. And they've got to figure out that, because what's going to happen is if they don't, eventually he's going to go into his walk year. And as we've seen, you know, this past February, those expirings are not very appealing.
No. And look, I'll be honest, maybe I'm crazy, but I've still got a soft spot for DeMarcus Cousins in the sense that I feel for him, man. He's been part of such a mess in Sacramento over the last 5-plus years. I don't know who could have thrived in that system. I mean, you put Kevin Durant in that situation. Would he be Kevin Durant? You put LeBron in that. I'm not comparing DeMarcus to those guys, but when you rotate coaches that often and you're in a non-functional situation really from day one, except for, you know, the short time that Mike Malone was there where he bonded with Mike and seemed to be on the same page with Mike, it's not a recipe for success. You can't, I don't care how talented you are, when you're in the situation DeMarcus has been in, you're not going to have success. I really believe, Bobby, if he winds up getting traded and he goes to a team with an established coach, with an established general manager, with a culture of winning, you're going to see DeMarcus turn around. Go back to the All-Star game. I've never seen DeMarcus hustle so much than in the All-Star game. He was going up and down the floor in a game that meant nothing, because I think being around winners had an influence on him. I think going to a winning situation, you'll see a different side of DeMarcus Cousins.
Well, it's all about culture.
Yeah.
You know, as far as when we're even seeing it with some of these first-rounders, too. We're guys, you know, are getting drafted in the late first, and they're kind of just floating around there. And then we see some kids in Toronto and Norm Powell and Miami with Josh Richardson go to these organizations that have developed such a strong culture and have strong coaches, and these kids have like taken off. So if Cousins were to be moved, he'll be fine. He'll be all-star level. There'll probably be some accountability there. The structure will be a lot stronger. That rotating door will end. And I look at him a lot like I do with Brook Lopez a little bit in Brooklyn, where Brook has had so many coaches, and it's so hard from a style standpoint, from a trust level. It's almost like your parent leaving, you know, constantly leaving. You don't know when they're coming home, you know, who's kind of running the house and everything. And there's really not much of a, you know, who's going to hold you accountability, you know, accountable if you know that person's not going to be there a year from now and everything. So that rotating door's got to close in Sacramento.
Yeah, and they've got to get real. I mean, they've got to decide, and I wrote this on Thursday, they've got to decide, you know, we want to be a legitimate organization. We want to have a culture that starts at the top that becomes appealing to players and to coaches, because right now what they are is leverage. You know, it's simple as that. They were leveraged last year for Wesley Matthews. I believe they'll be leveraged this year for some coach that's looking for another job that dangles a Sacramento offer out there in front of them. That's one of my predictions this year. That's what they become. And to change that, it's got to start at the top. You can make all the coaching changes you want. You can make all the roster changes you want. But you've got to establish a culture at the top. All the great organizations have that culture at the top, and they've got to figure it out out in Sacktown. All right, I want to move on to Minnesota. A team with maybe the most appealing roster out there for a young coach. Carl Anthony Towns, Andrew Wiggins, Ricky Rubio, Zach LaVine. I mean, another top 10 pick coming their way this year. I mean, that roster, if it was in L.A., you would have coaches fighting tooth and nail to get that job with the organization. And I don't think even Minnesota, that climate, that market, is going to dissuade many of the top coaches from going after it. Is that job, do you see it as appealing as I do?
The most appealing out of what we're going to see out there with the seven or eight openings. You know, if Carl Anthony Towns was playing for the Knicks, we'd probably have him, they'd be building statues for him right now, now outside the Garden and everything. So, you know, he's in Minnesota, and he's finally has kind of come on to the, you know, forefront here. I guess winning rookie of the month every the whole season kind of will do it for you. But that roster is appealing. I would buy stock in them. I need to see who that coach is going to be. But you've got the young talent to mold what you want, you know, your team to be. And the hard part when coaches kind of take over jobs, usually they're coming into a veteran-laden team where you have a sense of how you want to play, and you basically have to break those players down and kind of build them up how you want them to be. Here in this situation, you've got, you know, rookies, guys that are on 1 or 2 year, you know, in the league. You can come in and, you know, kind of hit the ground running with your identity. And that roster is appealing. There's some flexibility to get better this summer, add some pieces, and you know, kind of push, you know, from a lottery team to, you know, a team where maybe Utah is, you know, Denver. We've seen them take a lot of steps this year. But Chapman, and I'm not saying challenging for a playoff berth next year, but kind of get them to start playing some meaningful games here.
You know what I think, too, with Minnesota is whoever gets that job, specifically the GM job, maybe it's someone with both titles, who knows, at this point as president of basketball operations and the head coach. I hope they come down on this idea of trading Ricky Rubio, because I know they were talking to Milwaukee at the trade deadline. Jason Kidd was a fan of Rubio, of making a deal. You don't need another scorer at the point guard spot. And as much as everyone jumps on Rubio for his poor shooting, what Rubio does is exactly what that team needs. You need a distributor. You need a guy that's going to get Towns and Wiggins and LaVine the ball. I know LaVine, part of him, you know, probably wants more ball handling responsibilities, but I think Ricky Rubio, he's ideal for that team. He's the perfect fit with that group, and he's under a manageable contract as well.
Well, and you don't need a scoring point guard, and I think you need to be content on what type of player Rubio is. I mean, you also have to remember he's only 25 years old.
Yeah,
you feel like he's been in the league forever, but he's not even. He's kind of in the prime of his career,
and not even
his numbers where they are. They've been consistent. You know, I mean, you can maybe go to the health aspect where he has missed, you know, a bunch of games and stuff like that, but he's been relatively healthy this year. And when you have the horses with Wiggins and Town and LaVine and, you know, Muhammad, Dang, you know, those guys, if you add some pieces coming off your bench and stuff, you don't need him to give you 20 a night. I saw it in New Jersey when we had Jason Kidd. Jason was a terrible shooter. He got better towards the end of his career, but he was the setup man. And you had some horses with Martin and Kittles and, you know, and that group around him. So you need him just to play his role in Minnesota. And, you know, he's a good player. He is a good point guard. Is he in the Westbrook category? No. But I don't know if he needs to be right now.
You know what I think they need out there, though, is they need veterans that are going to be part of the rotation. Because my lay of the land out there in Minnesota was that even though KG is still an intense guy and practices, and you can learn just from talking to him, you don't get as much from a guy like KG when he's not playing. I mean, KG couldn't be the influence he was in Boston and to a lesser degree in Brooklyn, in Minnesota, because he wasn't playing. And I think young guys, you know, they're more apt to learn something and to listen to a veteran that's out there on the floor for 25, 30 minutes than a veteran at the end of the bench who's in street clothes for most of the time.
Well, I think the wrong approach is to go the route they did this year where you're getting a Tayshaun Prince for a year and the Andre Miller for a year, those veterans. I get you need veterans in your locker room. But you need veterans or players that are on a, you know, a 3 or 4 year contract,
yeah,
where there's some stability there and they're part of it, not where it's a 1 year rental and let's you know, mentor these guys. I think we're kind of getting past that stage with this Minnesota team where you don't need a 35-year-old point guard to kind of come in, or a wing that's kind of in a twilight of his career and everything. And I agree with you on the Garnett piece. It is a lot harder when you're injured or not, you know, or when you're not part of the team. And you could be in practice all you want, but when you're sitting on the sidelines and stuff, it just does not have that much of an impact.
Yeah, I got the idea. You know, Flip Saunders had the right thing in mind when he decided to do that, but you need guys that are more involved with the team long term. Like Tayshaun Prince, not going to be there. Andre Miller, he was on a previous podcast with me, critical of the young players in Minnesota. You're right. You need them more involved in 3-4 year deals than just the ones they were on right now. The New York Knicks. I guess things are trending towards Kurt Rambis. I mean, I go back and forth on Kurt Rambis because I'm convinced by various people on what he is and what he isn't. The pro Kurt Rambis crowd tells me that he's never had a team that's been his or a team that's had any real talent. Minnesota, Rubio wasn't there for one of those years. Johnny Flynn was the guy. It was his first chance at running kind of that combination dribble drive and triangle offense. Then he goes to New York and it's half a season. It's Derek Fisher's team. At this point, I don't know what to make of Kurt Rambis right now, Bobby.
Well, the Minnesota team he had was not very good at all.
No.
So, I mean, he inherited, it was a mess there. So to look at his record, where that is that fair? Usually when your first job is you're going to be taking over a team that's been, you know, a lottery team and everything. The second half of the season in New York where they were, kind of, you know, when Fisher got fired to how they ended, you know, it's hard to kind of get a baseline on, you know, if they're going to be there for the future, where this team is going. I think you need to look outside the tree here. I really do. I think you kind of have to take the blinders off. And even if Kurt Rambis is the guy, you've got to look at exhaust all your options. This will be the biggest hire that, or transaction that Phil Jackson will make, you know, in the next few weeks. And if it's Kurt Rambis and Phil's gone through the process of interviewing, you know, 4 or 5 coaches, and Rambis is the best guy, then God bless him. You know, then that's the way you do it and stuff. But I just don't know, you know, if it is Rambis, where this team will go, what will happen with Carmelo Anthony. What will happen? Is he appealing enough for, you know, cap space as far as to lure some free agents? I'm not sold on that right now.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see what the Porzingis factor is this summer. I mean, did players look at Porzingis and say, okay, now they're a little more appealing? Got Porzingis in year two. Carmelo still is a scorer. But Rambis, to me, I mean, it's hard, Bobby, not to, like, if you had to put money on something, you go to Vegas and you put money on one particular outcome, it's hard not to, like, put money on Rambis coaches this year or next year, the team struggles once again. End of the year, Phil Jackson up and decides to leave. And then Kurt Rambis is gone too, and they're right back to square one. Like, that to me, if they go the Rambis route, that to me seems almost the most likely outcome here.
Well, and the one thing you don't want to do is be in the same situation a year from now and start the whole process over, because then you're really behind the eight ball and you're looking for another head coach. And players get a little bit older. You know, Porzingis would be going into his third year. You know, Anthony will be in his, you know, mid-30s. You know, cap space is cap space. You know, it doesn't really matter where you know, if you have it, because everyone does. So, you know, if I was going to put money on it, I would say he'll be the head coach. And if things, and I agree, if things don't pan out, we're gonna have an impatient owner who will, you know, who's kind of stayed out of the way a little bit here, will kind of put his nose in the mix here, and you know, missing the playoffs again next year is not going to be acceptable for that fan base there.
If you're hiring a coach in New York, do you hire a coach who knows how to coach to Porzingis' strengths, who looks at Porzingis and says, I'm going to design an offense around him? Because I've been beating the drum about Rick Carlisle, and you know, every play that Rick ran for Dirk Nowitzki, you should be running for Kristaps Porzingis. It's you know, a mismatch with fours for Nowitzki and fives for Porzingis. I don't know why you're not taking advantage of that type of offensive system. Do you try to fit the player into the system, or do you design the system for the player?
Well, I think it's going to be important when Phil does his job interview, you know, when he starts interviewing, because that would be my first question is that get on the board, you know, with the coach and, you know, let's look at some scenarios where you have Porzingis out there as the feature guy and what, you know, what your offense would look like and everything. But, you know, there's four other players on the court, and, you know, as good as Porzingis had been in stretches, you know, there were some times when he did struggle this year. I don't know if it was fatigue, the long season. You know, we could put a lot into it. So there's some still room for development. So to kind of gear your offense just towards him, I'm not sure that's the right way to go. I think it's important to kind of put a bunch of packages in play that, you know, that does feature him. But that will be important, you know, for whoever they hire is that – he's your franchise going forward right now. You got no pick this year. You know, Carmelo's a little bit older. And, you know, how you build is going to have an eye towards with Porzingis.
All right, across the river, the Nets, they'll have an opening, I'm sure, unofficially, officially, whatever that is. That's an interesting job because if you take that job, you are clearly taking it with the understanding that you have some leeway, you know, to grow with it, because it's not a quick fix. You're not going to get free agents to flock there right away. You've got Lopez, you've got Thad Young, but you don't have much else. You don't have draft picks. You're flipping a pick next year with Boston. Is that an appealing job because it's Brooklyn? Is it unappealing because of the assets? How do you view that job?
Well, you're starting from the ground up. So the appeal is that if you can get it to work, you know, you're kind of looking like the savior. If you don't, then, you know, it's, you know, you could probably, you know, look at what's not there as far as, you know, lack of picks and some of the younger players. So with Brooklyn, you got to go in with the mindset. It's kind of, you know, almost like how you're going to go enter free agency is, you know, singles and doubles. You don't need a big name there to kind of sell tickets and lure fans. That never works. And to get a coach who has a strong player development background, we can look at, you know, a guy like Kenny Atkinson down in Atlanta.
Yeah.
You know, good name. You know, he's done good things down there. You know, we could look at Joe Prunty in Milwaukee. Joe, you know, did a good, nice job and everything, and probably names that don't sell. But we saw a guy named Joe Torre take over that Yankee job a long time ago, mm-hmm. and he wasn't a hot name either, and he did a pretty good job. So you don't need that in a big city, but you just need to find the right person. But the appeal level, I think you just have to have the expectation where this team is right now, where it could go. You do have some nice pieces, Lopez, Young. You've got Hollis Jefferson, the rookie McCullough, had some decent moments. You've got some space, you know, this summer. And you've just got to build it. You've got to build it the right way and go from there.
You know, Patrick Ewing has already started lobbying for the Knicks job. I'm sure he'd take the Nets job, too, if that came up and was offered to him. I could never figure out, Bobby, what the deal was with Patrick Ewing, because he was a great player. He's paid his dues. He's been a lead assistant on multiple teams. He's worked for great coaches, including, you know, what, both Van Gundy's and now Steve Clifford, who's one of the elite coaches in the Eastern Conference. It feels like if Patrick Ewing was 6'3", he would have had a job 5 years ago. What is, from what you've been able to glean over the years, what is the knock against Patrick Ewing?
Well, you're right. He has paid his dues. And how many times, I mean, rarely do you see a top 50 player of all time could have probably just kind of, you know, gone off into the sun, you know, sunset and done nothing, really pay his dues, kind of go start from the ground up and you know, kind of be on a bench as a lead assistant and hasn't even been able to get a sniff of a job here. And hopefully with Charlotte's success this year, getting into the playoffs, you know, showing some nice, you know, growth down there, that at least he can get his foot in the door. Is it that he's 7 foot? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I can't put up my, you know, pinpoint, you know, everything why he can't even, you know, get in the door here. But I have a feeling that, you know, we have, you know, 7 or 8 openings that, you know, he could be, you know, a candidate, you know, for some of these jobs, at least to get, you know, through this interview process.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And I'm sure there's a reason. I'm sure teams that have interviewed him have their reasons for not hiring him. And maybe there is a stigma against big men, because how many big men do you see can become NBA coaches? Most of them are guards. But it's always perplexed me that was the case with Patrick Ewing. Not even getting it. There's nothing that seems like it's ever been close, Bobby. Like, not even, to me, he hasn't even been a finalist. I haven't heard him being a finalist in some certain situations.
Well, no, I don't. He hasn't, and yeah, I don't know. I don't remember the last time he even interviewed for a job and everything. But The one thing I know is that he is itching to move over that one seat and to take over a team. And, you know, working for Steve Clifford down in Charlotte is the best way to prepare yourself and, you know, being part of that staff and everything. So we'll see what happens with Patrick, but I would be stunned if he you know, can't even get his foot in the door this time.
All right, let me finish up with Phoenix. And, you know, they're presumably going to have an opening there. Earl Watson finished the season after Jeff Hornacek lost his job earlier in the year. Good young team, pretty good. Some established players there. I think Devin Booker is kind of the cherry for that team. I think he's a starting two guard down the line with an upside to become even better than that. How appealing is that job, do you think, to prospective coaches?
Well, you've got to figure out the two-headed point guard, you know, system that they've kind of created with Bledsoe and Knight there, and if that actually works. So that's a concern for me as far as with that job. I love Booker. I think he's got all the, you know, the upside in the world. You've got Lennon Chandler as your centers. Teletovic's a free agent. He played really well down the stretch. And the one thing you don't want to do is kind of fall in love with some of the success you had down the stretch with some of these games. I think it's a good baseline where this team is going. But you've got pieces there. You've got a plethora of draft picks. I mean, you've got your own. You've got the Wizards. You've got Cleveland's this year. You've got some stuff you know, from Miami going in the future. Bogdanovic, the you know, Croatian player, not the one in New Jersey, Brooklyn, but
yep.
The one they drafted a couple years ago could be coming over. So there is a, you know, it's a good place. It's a you know, warm weather, one of those warm weather cities. So there are pieces there, but you're running uphill, you know, you're in the West. So it's another place where you've got to have those realistic expectations. I know they sniffed the playoffs a couple years ago, and you're kind of starting back from the ground, you know, but you've got to get some players healthy here.
I think Booker is eventually a starter on that team, a full-time starter on that team, which means either Knight or Bledsoe has got to go. I don't think one of them, they're too pricey to come off the bench, one of them at that spot. You could allocate your resources somewhere else. When you look at those two guys, is one more appealing than other on the trade market? Is one guy's value higher?
Well, they've got to show that they're healthy. That's going to be the big thing with, you know, Knight missing a chunk of this year and Bledsoe missing most of this year. And if I'm a team that's going to want to go after either one of them in the offseason, I need to see if they're healthy, because you are, you know, inheriting some money here. So as far as from appeal standpoint, you know, Bledsoe was always that player that kind of, you know, he came into the league, you know, late pick in the 20s and everything, and he just has not lived up to that level. And is it the injuries, the knee? You know, I don't know what we can point, you know, put a finger on it. But I need to see him play a complete season here and everything. And Knight, is it the product of the system in Milwaukee last year? Why he had so much success? He struggled a little bit in Phoenix. Is it playing with Bledsoe? So it's a tough call on both of them. There's just not too much of a body of work here.
It's funny how that team this summer, I mean, they were a finalist for LaMarcus Aldridge last summer. They were looked at as being on the cusp, and now it's, you know, that backslide has continued, and now they're almost in that sort of rebuilding phase right now. Fortunately, they do have Booker. They've got a pick. You know, that's something that is you know, going to be big for them going forward. But
and especially, and you know what it's a lesson for, Chris, is that when we look at teams and we say, oh, they look good on paper, that's what it is, paper.
Yeah.
You know, and I really like their roster this summer. You know, I like the Chandler, with, you know, I liked where they were going. And, you know, that, I mean, but then you've got a lot of things creep in, injuries, coaching change and stuff like that. So the paper goes out the window, and then the focus really shifts to, you know, that on-court product.
The one team we're not talking about at the moment, and I don't think we're going to be talking about over the next couple of months, is L.A. Every indication I've been hearing is that Byron Scott is more likely than not to get another year on that job. I mean, how much does that surprise you that it's looking more likely that Byron Scott sticks around?
It doesn't, and my concern, if that's the direction they're going to want to go in and everything, is that I would just lock him up for the next couple of years, because I think you're going to have a hard sell come July 1 when you're sitting at the table and with free agents on a guy who's kind of a, you know, either a lame duck coach and or on a 1-year deal and not knowing if, you know, kind of that aura kind of hanging over your head, not knowing if you're going to be here for the future and everything. And they've got, you know, $50 million plus in room to go out and get some players. So that's my only concern with Byron. It looks like he kind of found himself a little bit with some of these younger players, but he's still that stubborn coach and everything. And is it going to happen again with, you know, is Ben Simmons or Brandon Ingram one of these players? We're going to see what happened with D'Angelo Russell in here and everything. So my concern is just having a guy on that one-year contract going into the season.
How much of is it reality that the lame duck coach can have trouble, you know, earning the respect of players in that last year? It seems like that's out there as a narrative, but you've been around those situations. How difficult is it for a coach to maintain a presence in the locker room without that contract stability?
Well, you could see it go one or two ways. Either they can rally for you and, you know, try to win you, you know, your job and get you some years on that contract, or you can get off to a poor start and kind of let go of that rope knowing that you're not going to be back and kind of, you know, almost get into that quitter's mentality and everything. So, you know, there's two ways to look at it. You know, everything is, you know, great when the season starts or in training camp. I don't think that's a topic, but it's when, you know, late October or November rolls around, you know, where, you know, the thought process is, because the players know everything. They read, they're told, they know, you know, if a coach is going into his last year, that also has an impact.
Well, Bobby, great stuff. I know you're busy this week. Been a strange and busy week ourselves up here, so looking forward to talking to you again sometime next week, my man.
Sounds good. Talk to you, Chris.
That's it for the Vertical Podcast. Remember, you can download this episode and more on Stitcher, TuneIn, really anywhere you can download podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. Make sure you also check out the Vertical Podcast with Woj and the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick as well.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.